Dr. Judy Mikovits has been called one of the most accomplished scientists of her generation. Her 1991 doctoral thesis revolutionized the treatment of HIV/AIDS. At the height of her career, Dr. Mikovits published a blockbuster article in the journal Science. The controversial article sent shockwaves through the scientific community as it revealed that the common use of animal and human fetal tissues were unleashing devastating plagues of chronic diseases. For exposing their deadly secrets, the minions of Big Pharma waged war on Dr. Mikovits, destroying her good name, career, and personal life. Now, as the fate of nations hang in the balance, Dr. Mikovits is naming names of those behind the plague of corruption that places all human life in danger.
Welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm Christina Borgeson, here with my co-host Celia Farber. What you were listening to was a clip from an upcoming documentary called Plandemic, which you should watch for. So I'll tell you what, I've been made very aware by Dr. Mikovits and our guest today, who is her co-author on a couple of amazing books, that you don't have to be on a show called Naked and Afraid or go out to some jungle in Brazil or Panama to feel totally exposed to deadly beasts. Today's show is part of a two-part series that features the work of molecular biologist and biochemist Dr. Judy Mikovits, who you've probably seen in the news lately, by the way. And as you heard, she's endured all kinds of attacks and character assassination for some time among her colleagues. She even went to jail on some trumped up charges for sounding the alarm about the connection between a retrovirus called XMRV and chronic fatigue syndrome, certain cancers, and autism. The possible answer to how XMRV made its way into the bodies of millions of victims of these illnesses is what is so explosive and terrifying. And when Dr. Mikovits discussed that, the research community, top government agencies, and their scientists came down on her like a ton of bricks. But throughout all this, our guest, her co-author, Kent Heckenlively, has stood steadfastly by her side and has been recording, documenting her story in these two books that they have written together. They're one called Plague and the next book, which is the new one, called Plague of Corruption. It's not surprising Heckenlively has worked so closely with Mikovits and continues to help her fight to tell the world what's going on, because his daughter, Jacqueline, is autistic. Now, Heckenlively, besides being an attorney, is a science teacher and the founding editor of Age of Autism. Welcome to the show, Kent.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the first thing I think it's important to tell your daughter's story, because, you know, you have a dog in this fight for a deeply personal reason that resonates with a lot of people everywhere. So could you just talk about that first?
Sure. So it's actually a story of my daughter and my son. So our daughter was born first, born healthy. Everything was working out great for the first 6 months of her life. Then she, then around Thanksgiving, she went off of breast milk and went on to a regular milk formula. Come early December, she goes and gets her 6 month checkup and series of shots. And around Christmas time, we noticed the first head bobs, which are indicative of her seizure disorder. She was diagnosed with that probably about 2 or 3 months later. At the age of 3, she was diagnosed with autism, and then it's been just, you know, an incredible struggle because we've tried lots of therapies, but nothing has really seemed to significantly change her condition. Along comes my son, who, when he goes off of breast milk, he goes on to a hyperallergenic milk formula, which we did because we discovered a milk allergy in my daughter. And he stays on that till about 15 months. And then, because it was kind of expensive, we decided to switch him to regular formula. Well, I actually took him to his 18-month checkup, and because I thought that the pediatrician had missed something at my daughter's 6-month checkup, he went through a full developmental workup, looking appropriately, speaking 15, 20 words, you know, everything fine, tracking, everything great. Gets his shots. 3 days later, my wife, who is a speech therapist, says, you know, Ben has stopped talking, and he started pounding his head on the floor. And it was at that moment that I thought to myself, oh, my God, what happened? He was just perfect at the doctor's. And I'd heard this theory that that vaccines might cause problems, and I dismissed it. I just thought my daughter was the, unfortunate recipient of some bad luck. And so within a couple days of that happening to my son, I ran across the gluten casein-free diet and put both of them on it immediately. And after 12 days, my son said his first word again. And so I always say it's as if he was falling into the abyss of autism, and I did something and I caught him before he fell into that abyss. So he's 19 years old now. He's in college. He's studying to be an accountant. He's just got an internship with a Big Four accounting firm. My daughter's 21. She's still very affected, but I remain hopeful that there is something that is wrong with her that if we understand what it is, it can be fixed because she shows signs of exceptional intelligence. It's almost as if she's trapped in her body, almost like a stroke victim.
So, do you associate her illness with her autism with the vaccine? Do you think the vaccine was a contributing factor?
100%.
And now, how did you meet Mikovits, Dr. Mikovits?
Well, after that happened to my son, I felt like, you know, God kind of tapped me on the shoulder because he said, you've seen this terrible thing. Because somebody could reasonably say, oh, yeah, it was just a coincidence that your son was normal before he went to the doctor. But, you know, we don't really know how these things come on, and maybe it was just a coincidence. But to have my son snap back after 12 days, and you know, here's my wife is a trained medical person. I mean, she's a speech therapist. She works in a hospital. And as she always describes it, he also had some sensory problems during that time. He could hear things that we couldn't hear. It took about a year for him to catch up in language to where he was. And it took him about 2 years for his sensory problems to go away. So the fact that I saw within my own family that, you know, he got the shot, he got worse, we did an intervention that for some reason fixed his problem. I tend to think that what happened with my daughter is it's almost like some switch got turned, you know, off. And we've been trying for all these years to figure what's the on switch to get her so that her body can work the way, you know, yours and mine does.
Do you regret that you didn't do at the time, like change her diet or do what you did for your son, that for her, or did you just not, enough, or at that point that was your first experience? I mean, what difference, I guess, is my question.
None of this was even in my mind.
Wow.
This was 2000, okay? You know, so there's so much more out there. But, you know, the attacks against us still continue. It's just remarkable when we're talking about harm to children and all the medical establishment can do is attack us.
Well, there's a huge liability there that we're going to get into. But again, so did you reach out to Dr. Mikovits, or did she,
So fast forward. So I become an activist, and I'm an activist for many years. I'm one of the founding editors of Age of Autism. But in probably January or February of 2010, I heard about Dr. Mikovits, and she had published her article in the journal Science along with researchers from the Cleveland Clinic and the National Cancer Institute, and they'd found this retrovirus linked to chronic fatigue syndrome. Well, what she'd also done is she had put together family studies because from her work with HIV, she knew that, you know, HIV can get passed down from mother to child, and so since we're dealing with a heterosexual population here, it's likely that, you know, family members are infected. So she wanted to see, you know, she was starting out looking for patterns of other things like cancer, because the virus had first been discovered in men with prostate cancer, in their prostate cancer tissues. And one of the early observations she had is that it seemed like a large number of the women with chronic fatigue syndrome had children with autism. And so she thought, huh, maybe this is being passed down. And her work with HIV, and here's the thing that really gets me, because we get attacked so viciously, and all we're doing is taking standard practice in one area of medicine and applying it here. So if you are a woman who has HIV, and let's say it's being controlled with medication, and you give birth to a child, the first thing they will do is they will put that child on antiretrovirals, because the very act of a vaccination will stimulate the immune system. I mean, that's what it's supposed to do, right? But these viruses like to hide out in the B and T cells of the immune system. So you can go on to any, you know, when we wrote our book Plague, excuse me, I went on to the website for UCSF and pediatric AIDS, and you could find on there that it said, hey, before we give any child born to an HIV-positive mother a vaccination, we're going to make sure that child is on antiretrovirals, because we don't want the HIV virus to spiral out of control, damage the immune system, and cause AIDS. So all she did was say, hey, you know, parents have noticed this change after vaccination. There might be a simple explanation if a retrovirus is involved, which is, they're born with the retrovirus, but the body is controlling it. But the very act of immune stimulation might be causing the virus to replicate out of control, causing autism similar to AIDS. And so, that made a ton of sense to me. And she was one of the first scientists who, I think, really took the concerns of parents' observations clearly. I gave her a call, and she wanted to talk to me, and I immediately, within the first hour of doing an interview with her, I realized that this was somebody who was fearless, and she didn't care if she, you know, offended people. She wanted to get to the bottom of this, and I think that's what we want in all of our scientists.
Well, let me ask you something. I mean, did you... This retrovirus you're talking about is a retrovirus it's a mouse retrovirus, right? Mouse tissue retrovirus called XMRV.
Correct.
Okay, so did you have your kids tested to see if they carried that virus?
Well, there was no test kit available. They were part of a research study, and they did test positive for it. So. But, you know, that's within the confines of a research study. But, I mean, is there a generally accepted test for this? No, because what the scientific community wanted to do is they saw, as you had said, the potential liability for this, and they wanted to make this thing go away. So the crazy thing is you will find scientific literature saying, yes, XMRV is a virus that does exist, but it only exists in contaminated laboratories. It's never made its way into humans, which just sounds like the stupidest thing possible. So you can buy, I believe you can now buy, you know, products, which will decontaminate your lab from any XMRV virus.
Not only that, but Mikovits, she did her testing in labs that never used those tissues. So
yeah, you know, it gets a little wonky on the details, so I don't want to go too far into that unless you want me to.
To me, the details are what lit my hair on fire. And I'll tell you, the first detail that lit my hair on fire was that this is going back to 1934-35.
Yeah,
I mean, there was a big signal that something was wrong.
It's kind of an interesting part, and you
want to talk about that? Yeah.
I realize that I covered it in Chapter 5, and maybe that should have been Chapter 1. But here's the setup. So, you know, Judy tells me about, you know, I hear about this retrovirus. We have some discussions. And because, you know, I'm an attorney, I'm always looking for the scene of the crime, right? Okay, when did this start? So I say to Judy, well, okay, I get it. It's the mouse retrovirus. How did it get into human beings? And she's like, I don't know. And I said, okay, well, let's try to do an examination. So it appears that everybody in the field of chronic fatigue syndrome agrees where the first outbreak was. The first outbreak was at Los Angeles County Hospital in 1934-1935 among 198 doctors and nurses during the middle of a polio epidemic. Okay? So everybody gets that. Okay? So, you know, and you can find that written about in various, you know, textbooks.
And again, that vaccine had been cultured in mouse tissue along with an immune system booster, right? That had the mercury preservative, thimerosal or whatever it's called in it too. So they got this cocktail and all of them, did all of them come down with it?
No. And see, so what's interesting is, and if you learn much about viruses, you know that, you know, you can expose 100 people to a virus and, you know, maybe only get 30 or 40, you know, ever showing any signs of being exposed to it, you know. So what was interesting was so everybody in the field agrees on these facts. The first outbreak of chronic fatigue syndrome was among 198 doctors and nurses in Los Angeles during a polio epidemic. Okay, so you can find that in textbooks by guys like doctors like Byron Hyde. And so I was thinking, okay, this is really weird. How could the doctors and nurses get this and not the patients? The patients are more immune compromised, right? So then I found research showing that those doctors and nurses received an early polio vaccine, which was grown in mouse brain tissue. And also, as you said, given with an immune system booster, preserved with thimerosal and mercury derivative. So at the crime scene, I've got mouse tissue and I've got mercury, which is, you know, everybody has been screaming about the mercury for years. And I said, okay, that's like one wing of a plane. I'm putting another wing on the plane, which is the biological question. And so, you know, I presented this to Dr. Mikovits and I said, you know, check my research. Does this make sense to you? And she's like, wow, this is really amazing. And, you know, you also go back and you find, you know, presentations to the World Health Organization in 1953 about them saying, hey, we don't know if using mouse tissue is a good idea because there may be some virus that's latent in the mouse, but when you put it into human beings, it wakes up. Or, you know, you might get an immune system overreaction because the body is going, what the heck is this? I've never seen this. And so I found myself going like, wow, this is real solid science. It's a clear biological explanation. And we were actually quite pleased to see that in 2011, another researcher, Ben Burkout, in the Journal of Frontiers in Microbiology, published an article in which he said essentially what we were saying, and he said the most likely vector for this jump of this mouse virus into human beings were vaccines grown in mouse tissue. And so I think that was when the decision was made that they couldn't cover up the source of it if they kept talking about it. And so, you know, that's when we believe the decision was made that Dr. Mikovits and her research needed to be destroyed and discredited.
Now, let's talk about who made that decision and what steps were taken to destroy her. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the answer is it's unclear, but you say to yourself, where does this have to come from? There was a lot that went on. I mean, you had the collapse of, you had the people who were funding her in Nevada when the real estate market crashed. They needed money. They were trying to rush a test to market. Dr. Mikovits would not sign off on it. You know, here we see all these problems that people are having with testing and COVID-19, right? Okay. So Judy was standing up saying, hey, this virus exists. There are tests you can use. They are expensive, like antibodies tests. This virus, for a number of reasons, is not really good for PCR. So I think that her bosses had a reason to fire her because she wouldn't certify
this
test.
Well, can I just interject here for a second? Before her bosses got to firing her, first of all, when her research started coming out, the implications of her research, and this is the thing that, I mean, I swear, I got nauseous when I thought about this, is that if you've got people who are affected by these viruses, mouse viruses, that are in everybody, basically, because everybody takes vaccines, so now you've got, for example, a contaminated blood supply.
Yep.
Okay. And it's been contaminated for a while. So, I mean, the class action lawsuits from chronic fatigue, from autism, from, you know, all apparently what I seem to gather from everything I've read in your two books is that it tends to affect the neurological system. You know,
all of these neurological
problems that people have, like, you know, MS or ME and encephalitis and all that stuff. I mean, all of that is a potential suspect, but at least you were talking about this blood cleaner. And didn't those people have a blood cleaner, but another company had a blood cleaner, and she was saying that the people who owned the lab she worked for did not have a good product, but these other people had a good product.
Well, there's a couple different things. There's a blood test. You know, basically, you have some blood drawn. They see if you're exposed to the virus. For the blood banks, this company called Cirrus came up with something called the Intercept system, which uses ultraviolet light and a number of other things, and it's really a fabulous. Fabulous technology. It does decontaminate any viruses that might be in the blood. So it's wonderful. But as we say, it's kind of funny because in order to justify a system like that, you got to identify a threat. But what the government did was they basically said, hey, there's no threat to the blood supply, but hey, wink, wink, we're going to spend all this money for these blood decontaminators. So that was.
And they also called her bosses to have her fired, didn't they?
Yeah. So she received threats from Simone Glynn, who I believe is head of the National Heart, Blood and Lung Association. You know, it's a division of the government, and so they really wanted to make this go away. Now, one thing I just want to correct is all of the studies have shown that maybe 4 to 8% of the population is infected with these viruses. Now, that can be because, you know, contamination may be, you know, spotty, inadvertent. You know, you have some things that don't have this virus. But I think that what is also troubling is the bigger question that I raised, and I'm a science teacher, I'm an attorney, so I'm really good at raising questions, and so I go with my questions to Dr. Mikovits, and I say, you know, does this sound valid? And, you know, if it's not, tell me why. If it is, tell me why. And I said, Judy, it seems like everybody's fighting over this mouse virus, but let me ask the bigger question. Is it ever a good idea to mix animal and human tissue together and then re-inject that into the bloodstream? Now, you can do that through things called biologics like Humira, or you can do it with vaccines.
What's Humira? What is that?
I think it goes after arthritis and
Oh, it's a drug. Okay.
Arthritis. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a whole branch of medicines called biologics. Okay. And so I basically said, you know, if we understand that 7% of the human genome is silenced viruses, and we have to assume that animals are somewhat similar, and we're mixing that tissue together in laboratory conditions which don't have the benefit of the immune system suppressing it, I said, isn't that just like a recipe for disaster, because all of the viruses for the humans are going to come out and play, and all of the viruses for the animals are going to come out and play, and, you know, we may get, you know, one certain virus, you know, silenced, you know, or less pathogenic, but isn't there the risk that instead of just making this one crazy virus less dangerous, that you've opened the entire asylum of viruses and they're recombining and creating new pathogens because viruses are very promiscuous? And, you know, to her credit, I mean, this is why I love Judy. She thought about that and went and asked some people, and she goes, yeah, Kent, that's a great question. She goes, the only answer that comes back is that when her mentor, Frank Rossetti, asked that 40 years ago, he was told, well, yeah, there could be a problem with the animal viruses, but we know the human immune system is superior to any pathogen it might encounter coming back.
He pulled that one out of his left ear for sure, didn't he?
Well, yeah, and I just found myself going like, wow, that's an amazing assertion to just, you know, build an entire medical system on.
Well, the thing I want, because I wasn't 100% clear on this. I want to explain to our audience how a vaccine works, so you understand the importance of viruses. And you know, what happens with a vaccine is the concept of a vaccine is to weaken an exterior virus, right? So that a human will produce an effective immune response,
right,
to protect the host. That's you. Rather than injure or kill the host in cooperation with the virus. When viruses jump between species, this is why you have the interspecies virus thing, you know, why they use the interspecies. Their genetic structure undergoes changes that often makes the virus more benign. The alteration of a few base pairs as the virus jumps can create an adjustment that causes a previously terrifying virus to become a pathogen that the body can handle with little difficulty. However, the process can just as easily go in the opposite direction, turning a previously harmless virus into a killer. So the question is, how do you know when that's going to happen?
And that's the question that we ask. And it's kind of interesting to watch Judy go through all of these interviews because, from her standpoint, I don't even think she likes using the word vaccine. I think she likes using the word immunotherapy, you know, because there's this question, how do we properly train the immune system? And so she's very much in favor of, you know, let's see if we can tweak the immune system to provide protection for people. So,
what this reminds me of, Kent?
What?
This reminds me of antidepressants. Because in the antidepressants, you know, in a lot of people, you know, people take the antidepressants, they may feel numb, they might not feel 100%, but they feel better, you know, because they at least don't feel like they're, you know, going to kill them, want to kill themselves or whatever. But there's a certain percentage of people, including kids, that when they take, you know, their bodies don't react as well. and they want to kill themselves and they want to kill other people. So what you have here is a situation, and but you're still talking about between the vaccines, the adverse vaccine events and the adverse antidepressant, you're still talking about millions of people.
Yeah, and you know, and Judy's saying is, you know, when they do immunotherapy drugs in cancer, they're constantly monitoring the immune systems of the patients. And she says, how is it that we're doing all of this immunotherapy on children and we're not doing any monitoring of it? But I have an interesting story to share with you, which just, and sometimes I feel like I'm Forrest Gump because I just seem to find myself in interesting situations. So I think it was around 2012, 2013, since I'm a science teacher, I got the opportunity to spend a summer working at Lawrence Livermore National Labs in a virus lab because I specifically wanted to, you know, understand some of this stuff. So imagine they take, you know, us 30 or 40 science teachers and they want to do the big dog and pony show about how wonderful Lawrence Livermore Labs is. And so part of their presentation to us was how Lawrence Livermore Lab had just published this article using new viral detection technology in which they look at the Rotatec vaccine put together by Dr. Paul Offit. And what they found in the Rotatec vaccine was that there was a pig virus contaminating the vaccine. And so they were able to understand and they were able to use these technologies to look at the purity of the vaccines and find out that this vaccine was contaminated with a pig virus. And so, you know, here I am listening to this, and the guy giving the talk was Dr. Paul Jackson, who's just kind of like a legendary figure at Lawrence Livermore. And so here I am, Kent, the little science teacher, in the audience, and, you know, they do this big dog and pony show, and I raise my hand, and I go, Dr. Jackson, I'm just curious, how much more pig virus was in the vaccine than the virus you actually hoped was in the vaccine? And he goes, well, we think there was about 10 to 20 times more pig virus than our target virus. And I said, you know, he wants to go on, but I raised my hand again. I said, Dr. Jackson, the vaccine was only on hold for about 2 or 3 weeks before it was reallowed into the marketplace. I said, but as I understand it, one of the concerns about long-term virus exposure is that it affects the immune system and you may develop cancer. How were you able to determine whether this pig virus might not be causing cancer in many years? And he goes, well, we weren't able to determine that. And I said, well, isn't that something that you should ask the question about? And he goes, yeah, that would be really good. And it was kind of interesting because he actually seemed, like, embarrassed because he knew the question I was asking was real legitimate. And, maybe I'm mind reading, but it just seemed like he wanted to acknowledge it was a really good question I was asking, and it was above his pay grade.
Well, he wasn't. I'll tell you. I don't think he was expecting an informed consumer of his information. I think that was his biggest problem.
How to get yourself shunned by other science teachers in a few questions.
Well, I mean, you should have been considered their hero at that very moment, I would say. But I do want to talk about the malfeasance that litters the history of these this research and this science, because it's really shocking. Could you talk about there was a CDC whistleblower called William Thompson, who's talking about autism in African American boys. Could you talk about that? It's just so heartbreaking. I just want you to tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, so here's the thing, and I think we wrote Plague of Corruption because we kept seeing these patterns over and over again where government scientists, you know, run across troubling results, they try to get their information out there and they're shut down, or the decision is made to conceal the data. So let's go back to 1998 when Dr. Andrew Wakefield publishes his case report of 11 patients who their parents, I think 8 or 9 of the parents said that the appearance of autism and gastrointestinal problems coincided with their receipt of the MMR vaccine, okay? So, provocative hypothesis, but, you know, and the thing that we keep seeing is this overreaction. He published a case report, which is what happens in The Lancet. There's a specific section for that. And all he called for in his research was we need further study, because he identified the appearance of gastrointestinal problems in the gastrointestinal tract, and, you know, later on he sequenced the virus. It was the measles strain of the virus that was in these inflamed areas. So, and when they treated the gut, a number of these kids got better and some recovered. So the CDC, of course, wants to do a study on this, right? So they do a study on it. Dr. William Thompson, along with a guy named Frank DiStefano, Colleen Boyle, a couple other people, Marilyn Jurgen Alsop, they put together a study, and they've got a perfect way to test this. So previous to that, the MMR vaccine was given to children after 36 months. That was the recommendation. But the recommendation had recently been changed by the CDC so that it would be given at 18 months. Okay, so you have what a perfect data set, right? You know, so you've got one group that you got a lot of data on, they get it at 36 months, you got another group, they get it at 18 months, what's the difference? Well, when they ran the numbers, they found differences, and specifically they found it in a couple groups. The greatest effect was African-American males. They also found it in children who were developing normally and had no other health problems. And I think it was like a 3.5-fold increase in the rates of autism among African-American males who got the MMR shot earlier. And they even wrote in their notebooks, what do we do about the blacks?
And, oh, my God.
Yeah, you know, this is terrible. And what they did was they eventually published their findings, but they removed about a third of the African-American males from the study because they weren't born in this, they didn't have a birth certificate from the state of Georgia, okay? And they also came up with some crazy explanation that, well, maybe the slightly higher rate that we found was due to them seeking services. And what they did, and you can read the study, and it's really interesting, because to reach something called clinical significance, you need to have an effect which is 2.0 times greater, okay? They found it to be 0.346 when they had everybody in there. They removed just enough kids, claiming they didn't have a valid Georgia birth certificate, from the study to get the effect down to about 1.86, I think. And so they published it and said, whoa, well, you know, there is a little bit of difference, but it's not clinically significant, and there may be an explanation for it. So fast forward to 2014, I believe, and enter a guy named Dr. Brian Hooker, who is an autism parent. And,
can we go back to those African-Americans kids? Apparently, the CDC in its report concealed data about this group and calling it, quote, isolated autism, as if it were different in some way, even though what they meant by it was that these kids were developing normally before they took the vaccine.
Yeah, so that was another category.
Basically, what they did here was remove the right patient pool, remove all the some good patients from the patient pool, so that that's how you jigger the data. You rig the patient pool,
or you
cull it, or do whatever you have to do. But it's in the patient pool that they get to creating their fake numbers.
Yeah. So fast forward to 2013, 13-14, I believe. And Dr. Brian Hooker comes on the scene, and he has been trying to get Freedom of Information Act requests from the CDC. And in one of these kind of weird instances, he accidentally calls Dr. Thompson, who he had interacted with before. And in the course of their conversation, Dr. Thompson sort of puts Brian Hooker on the trail of this, because he tells Brian, he says, you know, you're asking for the data in the wrong way. And Brian's like, what do you mean? And he says, you need to ask for this, and then I can release it to you. And Brian's like, oh, okay, let me ask it for you, to you, in that way. So he asks it, and Thompson sends it to him, and he says, take a look at it, Brian, and tell me what you see. And, you know, within, you know, 45 minutes, Hooker calls him back, and he says, there's a huge effect here for black boys. He goes, yep. Hey, and so Brian is like,
Jesus.
Oh my God, what's going on? Why are you doing this? And, you know, it appears that Thompson was very upset that they had concealed this data. In fact, at one point, the study team got together in 2003, 2004, on a Saturday at the CDC to throw all of the incriminating data into a wastebasket and throw it a garbage can and throw it away. And Thompson, because he was one of the lead authors, understood that that was a violation of federal law. And he was also kind of like the technology person. So
yeah.
He hid all the files. And so he eventually ends up turning it over to Brian Hooker. He also, what Brian Hooker did was he thought, oh my God, we don't have this whistleblower disappear in the wind. So he consults an attorney, and he says, and he realizes that he could tape these conversations he's having with Thompson, but only if he's in another state. He was in California, so he drives to Washington State, has these conversations, records them, records several hours of conversations, and it's terrifying to listen to these tapes. That then becomes the basis of the movie Vaxxed. So, and Thompson even puts out a statement, and this is in my book, about saying we concealed data from our 2004 study that would have suggested that African Americans were at higher risk. Now, the other thing I just have to say is, even though that's quite amazing, you know, here I am a science teacher, looking at that study, I'd say, you still don't have a control group, because you don't have any kids who didn't get the MMR vaccine, right? You know?
Right.
Whenever they investigate vaccines, they come up with problems, and we see time and time again that they just decide to hide the data.
My God. I mean, these are agencies that use our tax dollars to perpetrate frauds upon us. I mean, that's what it sounds like to me. Am I formulating this correctly? Am I perceiving this correctly?
And to harm our children. One of the most shocking revelations came out about 2 or 3 years ago. So back in the early 2000s, I think around 2006, 2007, there was something called the Autism Omnibus Hearing. And so in the vaccine court, what they did was they consolidated 5,000 cases of parents saying that they had that their children developed autism as a result of their vaccines. So what they then did was they decided that there would be a number of test cases, okay, like 4 or 5. So first one was a girl named Hannah Poling. Well, she settled out for $22 million, okay? So boom, $22 million gone. Second case was somebody named Michelle Cedillo. And, you know, I question it, but the government's witness had said, well, I looked at this case, and I really don't think that there is much of a problem, because they were looking at this mitochondrial issue and whether if your mitochondria wasn't functioning really well, whether a vaccine might overwhelm your ability to respond. So that case was kicked out. The third case was a kid named Rolf Hazelhurst. And the government's own expert witness, a guy named Dr. Andrew Zimmerman, who was he had a very high position at the Kennedy Krieger Institute. He was ready to testify that he had seen information, because he actually wrote the expert opinion in the Hannah Poehling case, which got her that $20 million. He was ready to testify that in his professional opinion, so remember, this is the government's own expert witness.
Right.
He was ready to testify that vaccines, that probably one-third of the autism cases were caused by the vaccines. So the government's conservative expert is going to testify that at least one-third of these cases are caused by vaccines. And, you know, when he reported this on a Friday to the government attorneys, a guy named Vincent Matanoski, he reported to them on Friday saying, like, hey, you know, when you call me, you're testifying, I'm going to say that I think at least a third of these kids, it's caused by the vaccines, and I think this kid, Rolf Hazelhurst, is one of those kids. Well, that weekend, he was basically fired as the government's expert witness. Vincent Matanoski then went out and said, we know that Dr. Zimmerman has reported that autism is not caused by vaccines. So he did the exact opposite of what Zimmerman was going to testify.
So he misrepresented what he was going to say.
He misrepresented
it. He lied about what he was going to say, basically.
And so, you know, I was kind of curious about this. So, yeah, and so Zimmerman comes out in like 2016-17 and gives a statement saying, I was ready to testify about this. It only gets covered by like Cheryl Atkinson. But, you know, and William Thompson has turned federal whistleblower, and he's been waiting, you know, what, 5 years to testify, because nobody, Republican or Democrat, wants him to testify. And I went back and I ran some numbers, and I said, okay, 2007, you had about 1 million autistic kids. Let's say 30% of them are, you know, let's say a third have autism from their vaccines. So let's just make it real simple. We got 300,000 kids. The average cost to raise an autistic child to adulthood and then deal with their care is $3 million. 300,000 times 3 million is $900 billion. That was the liability in 2007 when Vincent Matanoski made the decision to fire their own expert witness. And so this is huge, and what's terrible is we could solve this problem for less than $900 billion, you know, because what Judy always talks about is, you know, she's part of the team that turned HIV from a killer into a manageable condition, and, you know, it's likely we're going to be able to drive the virus from people's bodies and cure them within the next 10 years. So a lot of the HIV-AIDS strategies could immediately be turned to so many of these problems, not just autism, but, you know, MS and Alzheimer's, and that's kind of why we talk about reclaiming faith in the promise of science, because we don't just have to worry about liability. You know, yes, that's out there. Yes, it's huge. Yeah, it's going to suck for the U.S. government, but we can turn this around. We can make this better.
But in the course of turning it around, you have to first admit there's a problem. I mean, I want to go back to chronic fatigue, because, you know, that's something that affects 20 million people worldwide. And, yep. And I find it very interesting, like a lot of British researchers, it affects apparently, in the majority, women. And, you know, yeah. This was of personal interest to me because my nephew married a woman with fibromyalgia. Okay. Yeah. And I mean, you could see like at 30 years old, there are times you'd look at her and she'd look like all of a sudden she'd get hit with a wave And yeah. She'd look like she was 90 years old, and she was in bed, and she was down for the count for, you know, 24, 48 hours, whatever. I mean, she really, and my, another member of my family who shall remain anonymous, but is a physician, kept saying, oh, she's just a drama queen. She's lazy. She's this, she's that. And, or she has psychological problems. And these British researchers are trying to say it's psychological. And some of the researchers on this side of the pond were trying to say it's psychological too. So I was quite taken aback when, you know, I was reading the book, and it was, and of course it's all about the XMRV retrovirus and causing chronic fatigue, you know? And it seems to me that there's still the recognition of this virus being connected to chronic fatigue is still not 100% solid, is it? They're trying to avoid that, too.
Well, think about that. I can think of no more horrible thing than to have a condition and being told it's psychological. I mean, a chronic fatigue syndrome has been dealt with in bad faith from the very beginning. You know, how misogynistic are those researchers to say those women just have psychological problems and that there's nothing physically wrong with them? They suffer tremendously. And, you know, I think it's a crime against humanity, you know, and I'm sorry if anybody gets offended by that. But, you know, if you are a woman and you have a condition, and it's, you know, it's almost akin to, you know, what happened before when, you know, a woman would say she was a victim of sexual assault and they'd say, oh, no, that didn't happen. That's a good guy. You can't. No, it didn't happen. It's all in your head. You know, screw you. These are real problems. And, you know, what's been remarkable is to see how the reaction of the scientific community is not to debate us. It's to try to deny us a forum to even speak. I mean, you know, Plague, published 2014, I think, has been a consistent bestseller, and we have not received one single review in the mainstream press or the scientific press.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody even wants to talk about us. They want to just pretend like we don't exist. But now that Plague of Corruption is the number one book in all categories on Amazon, all they can resort to is, you know, the attacks. But I don't think it's going to work this time.
I want to chime in here, Kent. First of all, this is Celia. Congratulations on your immense triumph with this book and being a it's a number one of the bestseller charts on Amazon, and you're weathering.
We finally beat those would-be teen vampires of Twilight.
Yeah, that's great. So there's so much I want to say. First of all, I'm not going to spend much time on this, but I had chronic fatigue syndrome. Except when I say that, I hesitate a little bit because did I ever get a diagnosis? No. But it was years and years, and I was destroyed. I didn't have the energy to stand up, to get dressed, to go out. So I don't know what else to call that except chronic fatigue syndrome. And I can just say, for me, the whole thing, it was a battle through just fog. And what I did, I just threw everything at it, every detox protocol, every diet change, and it took me about 10 years, and I've largely resolved it. And I don't know what it was that worked, but a certain turning point came when I learned about chlorine dioxide, and I listened to Kerry Rivera, and I ordered some. This is all within the last year. So if I had to pick something, I would say that was what turned it around. And that does have a powerful effect on all viruses and pathogens in the body. And it's safe, by the way, for anybody listening. The PSYOP out there is that it's bleach. It's not at all. It's a blood oxygenator.
It's so fascinating because I feel like I've become attuned, and maybe this is just my filter, but whenever I see vicious attacks in the mainstream media against something or somebody, I'll go, hey, I think I should look into that, or I should talk to that person.
You know, it's interesting.
Chlorine dioxide
if you Google
really
Dr. Mikovits right now, on what you'll see is like, boom, all the, you know, citations on the left side. And on the right side, there's a picture of her and a description of her. And it goes, you know, Dr. Mikovits is a conspiracy theorist, biochemist, and what blah, 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 whatever it is they say. But it's just right off the bat, just, you know, it's defaming. It's defamation.
Well, let me speak to this.
But you know what it is? In this current world, it's street cred.
That's right.
I remember reading about the woman who won the Nobel Peace Prize in Iran, and she was an attorney, and you know she was representing all these political prisoners and everything, and she is an attorney, a respected person, you know, it's a very high position of honor, and she gets arrested by the government and held for 2 weeks, and she has this kind of fear that like, oh my God, I'm going to be arrested. I've been arrested. I've been in jail. People are going to think I'm a bad person. And, you know, she comes out after 2 weeks, and suddenly everybody's like, welcome back. And they're like, what, you don't think I'm a bad person? And they actually said, no, we were actually thinking you might be working for the government because you hadn't been arrested yet. But now that you've been arrested, we know you're real.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah.
By the way, we only have 2 minutes left, and I just want to ask you just a quick question. It might be too much of a mouthful, but, you know, as quickly as, based on all these discoveries and everything we've been talking about here, are there any takeaway implications to be had with respect to coronavirus and the pandemic and what's going on now?
Yeah, I mean, what seems to be clear, and even our intelligence is saying, is that probably this virus escaped from the lab. And, you know, the wrong discussion is, oh, my God, maybe we need to increase lab safety. Yeah, sure. Okay. The bigger question is it ever a good idea to be, you know, using these viruses? And what they were doing was they were passing them through different animal species. So the coronaviruses in bats cannot affect humans unless you run them through other animal species. And, you know, they do some swapping out of the genetic code. And lo and behold, you know, it's got an HIV spike protein, you know, because you ran it through monkey tissue. Oh, you ran it through pangolin tissue. And suddenly pangolins, you know, you got a different virus. So, you know, and what we hear about, was it a bioweapon? Was it natural? I mean, that's kind of like a distraction. What you should say is, was this virus, did it undergo an unnatural evolution in the lab, something that would not have happened in nature, or if it had happened, would take centuries or thousands of years to happen? And I think that is what we're going to find. This is a virus that came from the lab. It escaped. And it's because we are doing these very dangerous things in their labs. I think the takeaway is there's a scientific elite that exists above presidents and prime ministers, and they don't like to tell their leaders what they're really doing in their labs. And I think that goes for the president of China, and I think it probably goes for our own president. So I think the world leaders have a big headache on their hand because they're going to find that the scientists of the, you know, of the industrialized world have probably been doing a lot of bad stuff in their labs. They didn't tell their leaders what they were doing.
They're going to unleash a Pandora's box. Listen, we're out of time, but I really urge our listeners to read both Plague and Plague of Corruption by Dr. Mikovits and Kent Heckenlively.
Say that the hardcover, the new hardcovers will be coming into Amazon shortly, but you can order. So just because it says it's temporarily out of stock, you can order it.
Skyhorse Publishing is the publisher, and you know, these are monumental works that everybody should know about and get into.